From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. This week on Story, we'll hear from documentary storytellers Chapman and McLean Way on their Emmy Award-winning Netflix documentary, Wild Wild Country. The six-part series tells the true story of a controversial Indian guru and his attempt to build a utopian city deep in rural Oregon in the 1980s.
This is not a traditional true crime story in that it's not an investigation into who done it or who's guilty or who's innocent, which is what a majority of kind of true crime stories are based around. We really saw this as an investigation into what led this religious minority group to commit all these, you know, atrocious crimes.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Wild Wild Country explores the true story of an Indian guru who attempted to build a utopian community on a ranch in rural Oregon in the 1980s, and the impending conflict that resulted with the locals. The series was created by documentary filmmakers Chapman and McLean Way, and went on to be nominated for 5 Emmys, including a win for Outstanding Documentary Series. Journalist Michael McCambridge interviewed the Way brothers at the Austin Film Festival. Clips of Wild Wild Country, courtesy of Duplass Brothers Productions and Netflix, Inc.
Everybody felt they were there at the beginning of the great experiment, like we were the chosen people.
I'm here in one of the largest ranches in the Northwest. Today, it's Rajneesh Burnham, because a prominent Indian guru and his followers bought it.
Our vision was to create a community
based on compassion and sharing.
Bhagwan's agenda was simply to raise the consciousness of humanity. That was his goal.
America was land of promise. It was my conviction we will have no problems.
I don't think America has a place for these people.
Everyone in Antelope mistrust Rajneesh.
I want that guru and his evil influence out of my city.
They're run by satanic power.
There is talk of vigilantes who may seek revenge on the Rajneeshis.
In 2014, around the time that Chapman and McLean Way were finishing their first documentary, The Battered Bastards of Baseball, they got a tip from an archivist at the Oregon Historical Society about a treasure trove of 300 hours of video drawn from perhaps the single wildest occurrence in the history of the state of Oregon, the establishment of a utopian compound in rural Oregon in the early 80s by the followers of a man known as Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh. That was 2014. 4 years later, they finished Wild Wild Country, a 6-hour Netflix series which won the Emmy for Best Documentary or Nonfiction Series. The genius of this film is that over the course of the 6 hours, you begin to see heroes and villains on each side of the conflict, and also eventually see instances of heroism and villainy within individual people. And it's one of those things, I've talked to a few other people who've seen it, people talk about, unlike most other documentaries, viewers can change their mind multiple times during the course of the 6 hours. So then take us through when your contact at the Oregon Historical Society says, hey, there's all this stuff.
Yeah,
it was. And you start going through it. Was there a moment where you realized this is not just a story, but this is, was there an aha moment where you realized this is what we need to do next?
Yeah, so what had happened was going back on Bagger Bastards, we premiered it at Sundance, Netflix bought it, and then as a part of that deal, we got some money in our pockets to go actually spend more money on the documentary. And one of those things that we really wanted to do was to really go through all those archives again and license footage that we hadn't been able to afford to license again. And I think it was on, like, I don't know, my 12th or 13th time, kind of down in the catacombs of the Oregon Historical Society. They have a big film repository down in their basement. And they have a huge wall of VHS tapes. It was 525 raw U-matic tapes, and it kind of just says Rajneesh above it. And it was almost like, it was, I think we just started talking about what the story was, and a film archivist had just started working there. He's from Brooklyn, and he started telling me the story a little bit, and it was almost one of those things where it's like, I mean, truthfully, by the time he got to, like, and then they bust in homeless people and they try and take over the county, like, by the time he got to that point in the story, I was questioning whether he was telling me something real or not. But really, and that first aha moment was not even so much about the poisonings or the attempted murders. I mean, obviously, those are fascinating parts of the story. But the first tape that we kind of popped in and watched, it was almost a realization that, like, these people in red have built a city in the middle of the Oregon desert. And that alone was enough for me to be like, I am so fascinated by this story, and I want to learn as much as I can about it. And then the person that really gave us the first idea was a guy named, his name's Josh Braun. He's from Submarine Entertainment, and he was a sales agent on Bagger Bastards. And we started kind of digitizing this footage and working with it. We had no idea that we could even possibly think about making this as a documentary series. And Josh had told me that he's like, I've seen this documentary series. It hasn't come out yet. It's called The Jinx. HBO is doing it.
Right.
And I really think that, like, you guys have enough footage and enough story here that we can put this together as a multi-part. And that was really kind of the first time that we just didn't even really think about doing it as a multi-part. To us, it was almost like Ken Burns was the only one that had ever really done these documentary series before. It was really early on in the day.
So then take us to the meeting with Netflix where you sit down with them and say, our next project.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting. We sat down with them and kind of pitched them, and they hadn't released Making a Murder yet, but they told us we have this true crime show that we're really excited about. And then I remember us pitching them that this is not a traditional true crime story, and that it's not an investigation into who done it or who's guilty or who's innocent, which is what a majority of kind of true crime stories are based around. We really saw this as an investigation into what led this religious minority group to commit all these, you know, atrocious crimes. And it was going to be an investigation into church-state rights. It was going to be an investigation into fear of the other, and things like that. And I think that really actually excited them, you know, that I think they felt like we've got Making a Murder, which is a little more traditional crime. Let's maybe take a chance on something that's a little maybe different. It is a quintessential American story, which we were kind of really interested in diving into. The whole cult thing was interesting. I think we talked about it a little bit in episode one, but coming off of the Vietnam War, like how disenfranchised the youth felt about the direction of the country and the government and Nixon and the lying and the corruption. And I think that people were looking for, there's got to be a better way to live. There's got to be better communities that we can support and build ourselves. And so I think that played a lot into it.
As a creative team, how do you decide what was the process like of this wants to be 6.5 hours as opposed to this is 3 hours
sure.
or this is 12 hours? Yeah. How did you guys chart that out?
It's a good question. Yeah. Well, the first thing we kind of did is we read about 20 books on it, and we watched all 300 hours of the footage ourselves. We knew, like, if we were going to do the story right, we can't just give it to an assistant editor to look at. We've really got to go through it with a fine-tooth comb and understand, like, the complexities and inner workings of the story. And so we started doing that, and we kind of worked backwards, which was, like, what are, like, the 4 or 5, like, biggest cliffhanger moments, you know? And kind of one of our pet peeves in serialized storytelling is sometimes they'll just throw, like, a random curveball at the end of an episode that maybe there's a big reveal of a character that's going to speak, and it's a little bit of a forced cliffhanger. We wanted the cliffhangers to play out in real time in the story. So in episode 2, when the hotel gets bombed, that's what happened at that moment.
4 hours pass by, and we get a call from Portland. Our hotel has been bombed.
Thank you.
Portland, Oregon today, three explosions rocked the downtown hotel owned by controversial religious cult leader Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh.
First bomb exploded at 1:19 this morning.
What concerns Chief Klum now? There might be more explosives in the building.
And so we basically found that we had like five of like these really great kind of endings for the episodes. And we knew if you're going to do serialized storytelling, you got to have people clicking on the next
episode. Yeah, I remember one that was just... The Rajneesh Purim was covered so much locally. Nationally, Sheila was obviously a very well nationally covered figure. But when we would pitch this story, we would always say, like, the one moment in the story where, like, ABC, NBC, CBS, everyone's covering the story on the nightly news is when Bhagwan got in an airplane and tried to flee the country, you know? And we had a lot of archive footage for that. And so even something like that, we knew, like, that's the end of our second to last episode. You know, like, that was always a North Star for us to how we want to build a lot of this series up. So kind of identifying a few of those key moments were enough for us in the beginning to kind of structure the show around.
We were able to establish the fact that they were heading to Bermuda. And Bermuda was selected for one reason only, maybe two. It's nice and sunny. And secondly, he was unextraditable from Bermuda. He would have successfully escaped prosecution.
It was an interesting evening. I don't think any of us knew how that would end.
One plane was going to refuel in Pueblo, Colorado, and the other was going to refuel in Salt Lake. We found out that there was a significant chance they were going to Charlotte.
One thing about this wild country.
The more difficult parts was episode one, when Bhagwan's building his following in India, which was like late 60s, early 70s. There just wasn't a ton of footage, as much as we would have liked. I think we pretty much uncovered all the footage that was shot inside the commune that you get to see. But we spent a lot of time trying to find great archive of the India days, which was really difficult. And then rights-wise, we didn't really have too many issues with rights stuff.
Netflix is pretty great to work with on that. I mean, I think that they knew that we're inherently working with footage that was shot 30, 35 years ago. The only things that we couldn't really get, there was a few characters. There was one character that we really, really wanted, tried years to get, and just couldn't get him. His name was Krishna Deva. He was the mayor of Rajneesh Purim, and he actually flips and turns state's evidence, and he's a huge reason why Sheila went to jail and why Jane went to jail. He was a key witness for the prosecution, and he was just, we were able to kind of get to most people, but he was just a flat out no from day one and just held strong. Unfortunately, I wish I would have had an interview.
Now let's start with the inspiration for all this, the Bhagwan himself. As I was watching the beginning of the series and you touched on his philosophy, I sort of got that the concept of mindfulness was not necessarily mutually exclusive from capitalism.
Right.
But then as you tell the story somewhere, I don't know, the 5th, the 10th, the 15th Rolls Royce, you start to wonder what this guy was about. How did you guys make sense of why all these people were in the Oregon desert? What did you think it was about the Bhagwan? Was it the time?
The truth is we read a lot of books of Bhagwan and Osho, and we would ask people, like, what is it about his teachings? And you would get 100 different answers.
Odd Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment.
We'll be right back.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We've been hearing documentary filmmakers Chapman and McLean Way discuss their six-part Netflix documentary series, Wild, Wild Country. When we left off, the Way brothers were discussing how they whittled down 300 hours of archival footage into their six-part narrative.
What we really found, which we focused on, is that most of these people found a very deep sense of community and family for the first time in their life. And a lot of these people had come from very difficult backgrounds or difficult childhoods. A lot of them were dealing with trauma. And for the first time, they felt like they were building a community that belonged to them, that was for them.
Jesus Santos finished a six-year term at the Colorado State Penitentiary last month.
It provides a sense of community, and it provides me with people who care for me. That's something I haven't had in my life. And I think that's something that not only people need, but I think it's the world in general.
It wasn't really until episode six when we were cutting the scene and we were kind of rushing to get it off to Sundance and we were super tired and really long hours. And it's the scene where Bhagwan has died and it's a funeral. It's kind of a funeral procession for him. And it was a really like odd realization that it actually wasn't, that crowd was maybe like 30 to 40% Sannyasins. That was a huge Indian crowd that had come off to kind of pay respects to Bhagwan as he had left. And they would burn his body down in the burning ghats. And for me, that was just a very interesting moment where one of my final takeaways on Bhagwan was like, God, regardless of whether you, how you feel about his teachings or whether he was a wise sage or not, was like he had created a 20th century religious movement.
His body was brought into the Buddha Hall. Placed up on the podium.
There are many other things that he said that we'll let you know, but for now, let me just say to you that in death, he was just as you would have expected. Incredible.
I remember that moment kind of fully kind of grasping at the end what Bhagwan had done in his life. And it was something that I maybe admired or appreciated. I had complex feelings about it. But I remember that, yeah.
And if the Bhagwan was the catalyst, the person who becomes the, choose your descriptor, protagonist, antagonist, sometimes both, yeah, is Sheila. And here we see somebody who is vastly capable, vastly devoted, but also has these dark corners, where the greatest strength also becomes the greatest weakness. Can you walk us through how you found her and how you convinced her?
So, like, the first tape we put in, Max said earlier, was them building their city in Oregon Desert. The second tape we put in was Sheila on the Ted Koppel nightly news show, basically giving him the middle finger and telling him to F off live on the news. And so immediately we're like, who the hell is that person? What? I don't know who she is. Like, we didn't know how big she was, but we're like, she is going to anchor this thing. Like, you could just tell right away.
We'll talk with the spokesperson for the Rajneesh sect, Ma'anan Sheila.
It's Ma'anan Sheila.
Ma'anan Sheila.
From Washington, Crossfire.
She is the personal secretary of the Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, who is the head of this
religion.
Thank you.
Bhagwan told me to be very, very strong in the media. I had to be provocative. I had to provoke.
Isn't your leader the free sex guru?
Free sex, we don't charge for it, if you mean that.
Right.
We are the only community which has no venereal diseases, no crime, no drugs, no alcoholism. And I'll tell you about one more thing, that we are the only people who enjoy sex fully. How could you do that? How could you? I said, don't tell me. I'm doing my job.
And so the more research we did, we found a really three-dimensional, complex female character. And, you know, my wife is a producer. We had some other female producers on the show, and they were really excited about this character that they felt like there's kind of like a lot of these male characters, you know, whether it's the House of Cards, Frank character, these very complex characters with a little darkness in them that are fun to root for. And they found that there wasn't really a lot of female characters like that. Like, you either get Wonder Woman, which are like these very easy, like, feminist heroes to root for, but they were really excited by the fact that there was this kind of complex female that we could really build as a three-dimensional human. And so Mac found a email address for her retirement community.
She runs retirement homes in Switzerland, and part of that accreditation process is like this: you have like information that's like publicly available through like these kind of Swiss government search back pages. But yeah, it was like, I don't know. I remember we've joked about this before, but it's like the email was like Sheila@hotmail.com. It was like something that I was like, this is never gonna work. But we emailed her, and again, it was actually one of the first hurdles was that our first documentary was on a Portland baseball team, which you wouldn't think would work against us, but like, I think Sheila was like, are you guys from Oregon? Like, that was like what she wanted to know, and we were like, no, we're actually not from Oregon, we grew up in Los Angeles, and it's because I think she's just like done with that whole state. But it was a bit of a we didn't have to sell her on it, but we just needed to build a relationship with her, you know. And I think that we were very honest from day one with what we saw this show being, but it did take about three trips out to Switzerland to work with her, to talk with her. She was in a very interesting point, and everyone had their own reasons for participating in the documentary, and everyone that participated in the documentary totally had a ton of reasons to not participate too, and they were very open with that. No one was just like, slam dunk, yes, I want to be a part of this.
One cool thing about Sheila, she was the only character that didn't ask for the questions before the interview. She was the only one that said, turn your cameras on, you can ask me whatever you want, I don't want to know beforehand, like, come interview me, which I thought was pretty cool.
There is this moment after the bombing, the firing of the hotel, where you sense that Sheila has gotten more and more resolute, and then her comments after that, it's that American moment of, I will not back down anymore. Yeah. And that was where I first got the beginnings of this weird resonance to the present day and to the two sides that are shouting and not listening to each other. And when did you guys pick up on that? And did you make a conscious decision to try to emphasize that as you were telling the story, or did it just naturally evolve?
That was kind of one of the things we found truly fascinating about the story was how the politics of it were kind of inverted to today's politics. And so you basically had this very liberal spiritual group using the Second Amendment to arm up with AK-47s to protect their community from violence. And so I was very fascinated by that. I have family members who hunt and are pro-gun. I'm not. I tend to be more pro-gun control. But when Sheila was looking me dead in the eye and saying, if someone bombed your hotel, if someone was coming after your kids, if someone was coming after your family, it'd be pathetic if you didn't defend them and arm up. And I remember sitting in that interview chair going, Jesus, like, how do I really feel about this? And how do I think about that? And I knew that if I was enjoying playing that kind of intellectual political game, that I had faith that an audience would also enjoy kind of doing some critical thinking and really diving into these issues to see how they feel about it.
I think that there was, in terms of like Sheila's character development through the story, that was definitely one moment. I think that even in episode one, we knew that, you know, Sheila, I am getting a little fuzzy on some of the details, but I think she was like 20 or 21 when she got married, right? And Chinmaya, her husband, had pancreatic cancer and ended up dying. And then, you know, literally 48 hours after her like first love that she's literally built her life around in America has died, Bhagwan just kind of lays down an ultimatum, which is like, now you're going to dedicate your whole life to this movement.
And I said to Bhagwan, I think Chinmaya is dying. And he said, you feel correct. But I don't want you to have tears in your eyes. Because if he sees tears, it will become difficult for him to die. And I did not let a tear fall in front of Chinmay.
And she just dies in head first. She's incredibly emotionally vulnerable. And she doesn't regret that decision, but that was just where she was at in her life at that time. And so I think that was like the personal commitment that she made then. But yeah, like that bombing, that end of episode two, I think was like the external like commitment, which was like internally I'm devoted, but now externally, like I'm gonna go on talk shows. I'm going to absolutely burn this entire system down.
Mm-hmm. And then as Sheila gets more and more obsessed, we're faced with, well, let me put it in the form of a question. Is it an irony or is it an inevitability that this commune, which in some sense is based on free love and everybody does their own thing, the person who runs it winds up going off the edge because she's jealous of this other woman who has a greater and greater role?
Yeah, I think it starts a step before that, which we found really interesting, which is a lot of cults and communes always implode from within.
Right.
And what we found really fascinating about this story was it was kind of the external pressures of, mm-hmm. you know, the government threatening to bulldoze their city and tear down their buildings, of, you know, going through all these immigration battles to keep their guru, who is, they claimed was a religious teacher. And so it was kind of all these external pressures that then started to like to make them kind of crack from the inside. And I think that's what's really interesting is watching Sheila's journey, is you realize like she's under an immense amount of pressure for a 27-year-old running this $100 million enterprise. And you can start to kind of see her crack. And I think that's understandable given kind of what she was under. I don't know. How do you feel?
Yeah, I think in terms of the inevitability, I think that, I mean, I think this is obvious, but I think that the story of Rajneesh Purim in a lot of ways is a story of completely two entrenched groups that like refuse to take any step towards like compromise or conflict mm-hmm. resolution or like communication. Like, and I think that our first day that we flew, Sheila had agreed to come on board and she was going to be a huge character in our series. And the first day that we flew to Switzerland was the day after Donald Trump got elected president. We didn't plan that, but that was just the way that production schedule. So we're kind of this group of Americans that are hopping on this like transatlantic flight to this rural part of Switzerland to go interview Mana and Sheila. And so it truly felt like when we first pitched the series and started contemplating it, it truly did feel like we lived in a little bit of a different time than mm-hmm. the time that we're in now. So I don't think consciously, though, we really tried to let the politics of today filter into the series, but subconsciously, I mean, they had to have, you know, I think mm-hmm. that's just being a human being in 2018. I think that, you know, we spent a lot of time with Sheila. We spent about, you know, 3 weeks of three trips out there. But the final interview was about a week long, and then we spent an extra couple weeks out there. So you develop a relationship with that source or that mm-hmm. talking head. I think it's a little bit different than someone who works at a newspaper and is calling someone for a source. Right. It's a different type of relationship. And I think that we would wrap filming with Sheila, and my brain would always kind of think one way and be like, man, Sheila just gave some compelling arguments during that interview. And I'm really interested in that. And then we'd go spend 3 weeks in Antelope, Oregon, and we'd spend time with those people. And that's Trump country. You know, yeah. I mean, those are Trump voters out there. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. But someone like John Silvertooth, who's the mayor of Antelope, you know, would ask me a question. I remember him being like, do you know what it's like? Can you imagine what it's like trying to raise a family or a five-year-old or four-year-old? And you look out the front porch of your window and you see people in red with AK-47s walking down your street. Mm-hmm. He's like, can you imagine what that's like? And that, I mean, questions like that would kind of knock me on my ass. So we were feeling compelling arguments on both sides and felt like as we edited the documentary series, that wasn't just an accurate reflection, but also kind of gave it wind in its sails and as it carries through.
Remember this guy up here sitting with his shotgun on his porch, you know, I'll never sell to them. 2 weeks later, you know, he's got the check in his pocket. And you're talking about older people, you know, on a fixed budget. Then Sheila comes in with her gold pens and diamond rings and says, I'll write you a check for $50,000 for this place. And people go, well, you know, how can I say no to that and take the $50,000 and run?
And Sheila had said, if they don't sell now, they'll sell later at my figure.
Homeowners were very happy to sell. They had their properties for sale for years. Nobody was buying it. It was a ghost town. And here, finally, they have a lucky day where they could sell.
And back to Sheila, and because you were asking about Hosea, right, who came, the Hollywood producer who kind of came in and was supposedly going to be the new secretary. And I think we were really interested in that storyline because for a group that was all about like enlightenment and being bigger than your ego and not having jealousies, I was very interested in the fact that it was kind of like the frailty of the human psyche that we all suffer from, and our egos, to like watching someone kind of take power from you. Is never easy, no matter what gender you are or, you know, who you are as a human.
Access to Bhagwan was everything. He would invite them to come and spend time with him without Sheila to accompany them.
When you start having Hosea, a rich woman from California who had fairly recently come to the ranch, Sheila felt threatened. She suspected that there were other people now who were having his ear.
Bhagwan even went so far as to call Sheila into his house and to explain to her another corporation was to be set up, and Hosea and John would run this corporation. That made Sheila really, really angry.
Now, talking about the interviews, certainly Sheila had some things she wanted to get off her chest. Philip was almost the proxy narrator in the way of bringing you up. But I'd like to hear about the interviews with Jane Stork, because that was, to my view, a more nuanced, more difficult project of getting somebody who was this gentle soul at heart to talk about how her devotion led her to attempted murder.
Sure.
On the eve of Master's Day, July the 6th, 1985, Sheila called a group of us to her house. Sheila looked terrible that evening. She was really pale, and she told us, "Tomorrow, Bhagwan is going to orchestrate his death. Tomorrow, Devaraj is going to kill him. We've got to stop it. We have to do something. If we can stop Devaraj, if we can kill Devaraj, Bhagwan won't die. Who will do it?"
What was that process like?
Yeah, I've talked about this before a little bit, but you know, when we were first starting our careers, we had a friend who worked for James Marsh, who did Man on Wire and Project Nim. And I remember my friend told me, you know, James, when he does his interviews, he spends weeks with his subjects before he even rolls the camera. And, you know, we spend a lot of time with our subjects before we press record. And Jane was someone who, you know, is in Europe. We also took a couple flights out there to spend time with her and her husband and her family and really get to know them. And we have honest conversations.
But Jane was like an interesting counterweight, I thought, to, because, you know, Naran, the attorney, Philip, like he is died in the wool sannyasin, and he will defend Osho until the day he dies, no doubt about it. And that's why I was very interested in interviewing him, because I never thought it was a bad thing if we're interviewing someone that has an incredible agenda or stakes in the interview. I always thought that was a great thing because we can counteract it with other voices. And so Jane was kind of somewhere that was, you know, her perspective was, we talked about wanting a sannyasin that could give a compelling argument for how destructive this was in their lives. And I think that's what Jane was for us.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International, we'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Wild Wild Country filmmakers Chapman and McLean Way. Before the break, Chapman and McLean were discussing how the 1980s set story reflects the politics of today and how they developed relationships and trust with their subjects.
Jane was kind of somewhere that was, you know, her perspective was, we talked about a Sun Yat-sen that could give a compelling argument for how destructive this was in their lives. And I think that's what Jane was for us. And, you know, Jane's life obviously was incredibly traumatized by her joining the Sun Yat-sens. But she was someone that we spent a ton of time with, and it was there. One of her big monologues, one of her big moments she has in the series is when she walks you point by point by point by point the day that she tried to kill Bhagwan's doctor and ended up putting a needle in him to try and kill him with adrenaline. And I think that that probably isn't a answer that you were going to get by kind of parachuting in and putting a camera on and asking questions. That's an answer that she knew was going to come up and she was going to have to deal with. But we wanted to hopefully empower her in a way to talk about that.
And I think, like, it could have been so easy to like gawk at these subjects and make them feel like zoo animals and like these bizarre brain dead cult people and like look at this crazy woman trying to kill people. And so we really talked to them like as honestly as we could, as like that's not our agenda. Like hopefully an audience is gonna like understand what led you to this moment, you know? And I think she has a very tragic story, and in that moment, you know, she truly felt like she was protecting Bhagwan's life, you know, and you get to see the complexity of the darkness in her. And, you know, one of my favorite quotes is Philip at the end of 3, where he says, you know, there's darkness in all of us. It doesn't make you a bad person. And I think that applied to a lot of people in this story.
I turned and walked away. I walked through the crowd. I walked out the other side, and I walked back to Jesus Grove, where I lived, completely alone. Nobody spoke to me, and I spoke to nobody. And I wanted to be alone. There was the part of me who felt I had saved Bhagwan's life. I had done what I had to do. But deep inside of me, I was shattered. I'd grown up clearly understanding that thou shalt not kill. And now I had tried to kill somebody. What had happened? I knew I had gone beyond the pale. I knew I had stepped over the line.
Why did this experiment in self-reliance and transcendentalism go berserk? Did either of you come up with a set answer to that question?
I mean, I think it's something that our answers never stayed the same. They constantly evolved or went back or changed or went left or right.
What about today?
I think that was one of the things that we felt in Wild Wild Country and editing that, because we showed up at the same house every day to edit this documentary series with our editor, and our oldest brother did the music, and Chap's wife, Julie, was our producer. And we'd all have very different opinions, and those would evolve. But yeah, I think that one of my early takeaways in researching the story that I did probably come a little full circle around on was that I don't think that the Rajneesh's intentions were to come to Oregon and poison 750 people. I don't think that was kind of what they set out to do. I think that they did try to set out to create a model utopia that hopefully could be replicated, and they found a lot of happiness in the utopian commune that they had founded, but through a series of intense conflict on the outside, they did go down what we would know mostly call a cult.
Before the polls opened this morning, the Rajneesh had a comfortable lead.
As of last night, it was 52-39.
2 hours later, the townspeople had reduced their deficit to 3. By midday, it appeared a majority of the more than 90 registered voters were Rajneeshis.
Final tally, yes, 42, no,
55. There was nothing that we left out, but there were three kind of huge legal battles that, like, I wish we could have gone into detail more on, because the actual court battles were fascinating. And that was one, the land use issue, which happens in episode two, which is this exclusive farm use, or can you build out in the middle of nowhere, which was very specific to Oregon, but it was a fascinating court battle that went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Rajneeshis ended up winning.
My name is Bill Bauerman from the Rajneesh. They came in and represented that they were going to have a nice agricultural unit on Mud Creek Canyon. They call it the Big Muddy Ranch. They have been in violation of our ordinances. They've been in violation of our laws. So it became apparent that they were really not an agricultural group. I feel very strongly about this.
Ultimately, they were right from the beginning that they did have the right to build their community out there, which was a fascinating legal battle. The second one was the church-state battle, which is, you know, can a church run a government, a local government like this? Can they run the city? And that was also 5 years of court battles and repeals and petitions that we couldn't go into. And then the third one was the immigration battle, which was fascinating. So we kind of gave you guys a quick overview of all of those. The government's there to make sure, like, religions don't run government, but at the same time, they're also there to protect religions from the government kind of coming in. And this one was kind of split right down the middle. And it was a fascinating, it was another thing where, you know, we could have done a whole episode on that battle. And I think for me, kind of politically and philosophically, was the kind of one topic I had the most fun kind of going back and forth on.
Yeah, there was one section that was kind of what we always called a day in the life, which we asked. We don't usually do this because we really approach each interview separately, but there was a few questions that we asked every single person that we interviewed, or every sannyasi we interviewed. And one was just like, immerse us in your world and give us a beat for beat of just your average normal day on the ranch. Just nothing spectacular, but just, and the answers were just the most beautiful answers like I had ever heard in my life. It was like they would talk about how sometimes they'd sleep in a little bit, but then they'd wake up and they'd go have tea or coffee with friends, and there was no strangers on the ranch. And to me, that was like, why is Bhagwan not such a big character in the series? Because we always felt like the reason they're there might be, they might say it's because of Bhagwan, but it's the family and a commune that is like attracting these people together. And I don't know why, but we edited it together. It was like 5 minutes long, and we just could never find a spot in the series. The conflict was just accelerating so fast that we couldn't ever really take our foot off the gas and cut this section in.
People in reviews have been like, wow, you guys were so fair to everyone. And we never did that to like pat ourselves on the back and be like, oh, look how objective we are, and like, we're such good guys. And like, it was really, we felt like selfishly it was the most entertaining way to make this documentary. This is legitimately a story about two sides. Not every story you do need to hear both sides. Our first documentary was about independent entrepreneurship against corporate baseball. And so, you know, we didn't interview Major League Baseball because it wasn't necessary to that story. This one, like, we literally, it is a battle of two different points of view. And so that's inherently what the story's about. And we talked about, like, if you go to a boxing match, you want a really good boxing match. You don't want just the guy to get the kicked out of them in the first round and then the story's over. So we knew if people are going to stick around for 6 hours, we need to elevate everyone's argument. We're not there as a journalist to tear their arguments down and poke holes in their argument. That's going to deflate it, and by episode one, who cares anymore? So we found, like, what are their most valid arguments, and let's beef those up, and then let's let them go head to head in like a boxing chess match, and then see where the chips fall.
You know, it's so interesting because I don't want it to sound like I'm complaining about that, because one of the a standard thing that we want from all of our interviews, and whether this is Wild Wild Country or Better Bastards or the projects that we're doing now, is like, we always talk about stakes in the interview. Like, we want our interviews to have stakes in the stories that they're telling and how they're doing. We actually like when they have agendas. We like when they have arguments to give. I will say that, like, Naran, the attorney, was someone that this was the most important thing that had happened to him his entire life. But I think that's fair to say about Sheila. I think that's fair to say about Jane. I think that's really fair to say about John Silvertooth, who's the mayor of Antelope. Like, 1981 to 1985, this four-year stretch of Antelope's battle with Rajneeshpuram was, I think, the most important thing that had happened in these people's lives. I think it was the most traumatizing thing that had happened in their lives. I think it was the most significant thing. Naran was someone that had probably the most stakes and agenda in how this story is told. And I don't know if we really told entirely his version of his perception of these events. We showed that he feels that way. But he was someone that really wanted like tight controls over the reins over his interview and what he talks
and
about.
Just
but
real
that's
quickly,
not bad,
I
though.
Think everyone was reluctant. A lot of sannyasins were like, we've always been painted as these brain dead cult people, terrorists. Like, I don't want to be involved. And a lot of people in Oregon were like, we're always these one dimensional racist bigots. And so kind of eventually what got a lot of these people on board was like, look, people don't remember this story. It's going to the dustbins of history. Like, if you think there's something important in this story that a new audience should know, now's your time to do it. And both sides were like, yes, this is an important story that needs to be told for two completely different reasons of why they thought it was so important, which was really interesting to us. And I'm not interested in facts. That's why when people are like, what did they believe? I'm just like, I don't really give a shit, to be honest. You know what I mean? Like, I want to feel something. I want to experience something. I want to be challenged. I want to be provoked. I want a cathartic feeling when I watch. And who knows how that happens? But for me, it's not just learning math or learning facts about the years, about when everything happened. So as a filmmaker, that interests me less.
I will say, like, the great thing about making archival documentaries is you know beginnings, middle, and ends. I mean, that doesn't mean that you exactly know how your interviews are going to unfold. I think you still have to remain flexible in some ways. But, you know, we've gotten to know the Making a Murder filmmakers, and it's like when they spent 11 years making that series, you know. It's a court story, so just they never really knew when it was going to end. So we really did kind of each episode, we had like an 8 or 10 page kind of, we called it a Bible. Like, each episode had like an episode Bible that has like an inciting incident, like a page 8 moment, a cliffhanger. And I think that that's just our approach with documentary storytelling. I think there's also like a practicality to it too. I remember in between Battered Bastards and Wild Country, one of our Netflix executives said, like, you know, something like 80% of Netflix users will like click off within like 30 seconds of watching something, you know? So the first 10 minutes of Wild Wild Country is meant to be a hook. Like, it is, like, we kind of lay it all out, and it's meant to get audiences in to be like, yeah, I'm definitely going to watch the rest of this episode, and hopefully we can get them to watch more and more at that point. As far as the editing, we got really lucky early on. We hooked up with an editor right after we had gotten Battered Bastards into Sundance. He's actually a commercial editor that edits at a commercial firm called Rock, Paper, Scissors in Santa Monica. And I think most people would be like, that's insane. Like, you would never have a commercial editor edit documentaries. But for us, it was like a match made in heaven. Like, he knows how to accelerate. He knows how to cut. And then for us, like, yeah, we're usually in there like kind of every single day.
And I think editing, we're just really big on like cause and effect. Like, this happens, therefore this happens, therefore this next thing happens, which leads us to this. And again, instead of just trying to cover a story and give you the A to Z, I think making that cause and effect is what makes audiences lean in and like want to continue watching.
We were so spoiled with our locations. Like, we had, before we even really knew what Wild Wild Country was going to be, or that we had just totally gone in on the story, we just drove to Antelope. We were in Portland at the time wrapping up Battered Bastards, and it's only about it's like two and a half hour drive out there. And I mean, like, you come in down the hill and you kind of see that town, and it's like a Hollywood film set or something. I mean, it's really authentic. It's genuine. I'm not saying it's fake, but it's just like, it is such a character itself, you know? It's like a time capsule. Yeah. It like hasn't changed in like 50 years. It like matches all the archive footage. And then Sheila was in Switzerland and Jane was in Germany, and we had, you know, Noran was in the up in near Seattle. And it's like, we just had really great locations that really were almost characters themselves. Like, Antelope, we wanted Antelope to be a character itself.
And yeah, I think so. We kind of sent it out to our subjects, and we honestly, when we were sending it out, we were like, everyone's gonna hate this. Like, no one's gonna like it that we interviewed. And I remember like a couple of the Antelope characters called us up, and they're like, you guys made us look awesome. Like, you guys rock. Like, we look so cool. And I was just like, oh, okay, great. And you know, we had to send it to Sheila, and we were a little bit nervous about that, you know, because we'd gotten to know Sheila well. And you know, she'd emailed us back like, wow, I'm so proud of how I handled all that bigotry and racism directed towards me, and what an incredible job I did out there. So we're like, oh, all right, like, everyone likes it. And then sannyasins, like, I got a ton of Facebook messages after it, and it was everything from like, I know where you live, and to like, you, this is the most like profound thing I've ever seen on Bhagwan. Thank you so much for capturing the story. So the reaction from sannyasins was kind of like, it was all over the map a little bit.
What's the most important thing you learned about filmmaking during the making of this film?
The most important thing I learned as documentary filmmaker is I became really, really interested in the idea of letting your documentary subjects hijack your narrative. And I think as a documentary filmmaker, you always want control, and you want to control the narrative, and you want to fit it in your box. And when Sheila would go off the rails and start pointing at the camera, it was like she's holding the audience hostage right now. And it's this very tense feeling that you get when watching it. And whether it's Naran or Jane when she tells her story, instead of us just grilling and asking questions, giving people a platform to put the audience in the moment and you get to relive it, I think is a very kind of new and exciting style of documentary filmmaking that we're trying to expand upon.
Yeah, it's a great question. I would think it's like, for me, it was getting used to, on a day in, day out basis, making, you know, 1,000 decisions, like really, and that, and not maybe 800 of those are going to be, how do you edit this documentary series? But a ton of them, you know, when we're trying to deliver for Netflix and Sundance, there's color, there's sound mix, there's a ton of people that you need to finish this project. And I think that it was, we planned a ton, but at a certain point, I think every project becomes this way, but there was, this sounds like I'm bragging, but I'm just trying to be honest. There was something like putting 6.5 hours together was something that there was no blueprint for. I mean, actually, we did see Ezra's OJ Made in America, and that gave me incredible confidence that it's like, it can be done, and I love that documentary series. But I think it was almost like, it becomes like an orchestra that you're conducting towards the end. Things are just incoming, and you're trying to do your best to make the best decisions possible to make this documentary series as well as you can. And I think that at the end of it, when we had finally wrapped after like 4 years of this, it kind of was a realization, which was like, the Rajneeshis went and, like, they built their city, and like this was me, this was my thing, like this is like, this is my Rajneeshpuram, like this is like what I spent 4 years of my life doing, like, and it was pretty incredible to do it with family too, like we're brothers, and our oldest brother Brocker does all the music for our things, and we have a really tight kind of working group that we do, and we all kind of, I don't know, came out on the other side with something that we're all really proud of, and we're thrilled with the reception that we've gotten. But talking about it this far out, we don't usually talk about Wild Wild Country so much anymore. There are things like that I miss now. Like, I miss going into that edit bay every now and then, and like, just all we had to do was make Wild Wild Country, and we would have great, crazy, fascinating arguments, debates over how we wanted things, how we felt about the story, how we felt about the characters, how we felt about the series. And I didn't think I would miss that, but I really do.
It is not good and bad, right and wrong, black and white. Of course, I don't know when I die, I come in hell or heaven, but it doesn't matter. Wherever I come, I will create my own paradise.
On Story is a part of a growing number of programs in Austin Film Festival's On Story project, including the On Story PBS series, the On Story radio program and podcast, and the On Story book series. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, Bita Gassemi, and Maya Perez. Our audio is recorded by Travis Kennedy, and our editor is Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from the Sound Lab, Inc. and KUT 90.5 in Austin. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.